Good evening and welcome. It's always such a pleasure to welcome folks to the Leadership Lecture Series, and we have had and are continuing to have a fabulous season in spring 2024. My name is Nicola Pitchford. I'm the president of Dominican University of California. The Leadership Lecture Series is a program of Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies, a leadership development center that offers education and training to students and professionals, inspiring them to become better leaders, and also better team members, I would say. The purpose of the Leadership Lecture Series is to engage our students, the campus, and our community in conversations about that are on socially relevant issues. I'd like to thank everybody at the Institute for Leadership Studies, led by Executive Director Dr. Denise Lucy, who make these inspiring lectures possible, and also to our student leadership ambassadors who helped us find our places and make sure that our guests are always greeted and that we are able to have lecture events that run smoothly through their good work. The Leadership Lecture Series is conducted in partnership, as you know, with Book Passage. And I think you probably also know that Book Passage, which is the San Francisco Bay Area's prized independent bookshop, is also much more than a bookshop. It really is a community center, and it is a treasure for our community. In the and we've been partnering with Book Passage now for 19 years, and that's 19 of the almost 20 years that the Institute for Leadership Studies has existed at Dominican. We are looking forward to celebrating 20 years of the Institute for Leadership Studies. The Leadership Lecture Series in partnership with Book Passage has been a key part of the Institute's work for those 19 years. We've presented speakers who inspire acts of leadership across disciplines and sometimes in the most unexpected ways, with over 155 world-class authors and change leaders. And so we are very grateful to Elaine and to Bill Petrocelli and the Book Passage team for your vision and your commitment to education and community building. And I'd like to take a few moments to acknowledge our generous sponsors this evening. Our diamond sponsor for the Spring Lecture Series is Christine Christensen of Engel and Volkers. Thank you, Christine. Christine has represented Marin's luxury real estate market for 20 years. She's also a founding member of Dominican's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council, and she earned her MBA in international business here at Dominican. Thank you, Christine, for your ongoing support. We also have two silver sponsors for tonight's program. The first is Dominican's aforementioned Women's Leadership and Philanthropy Council, a year-round sponsor of this lecture series. The council is a giving circle that inspires women to lead, collaborate, and to contribute to their community. Thank you to the WLPC for your unwavering support of this series. Next is a new sponsor to the series, Charles Schwab, and our Schwab friends are well represented here tonight. Schwab supports a wide range of nonprofits and community service programs that allow employees to give back in areas that they care about to causes and organizations in their locality. We're particularly grateful to Dominican alum Mike Davis, who earned his MBA from Dominican, who is vice president and senior financial consultant with Charles Schwab in San Francisco. And thank you, Mike, for, I've lost you for now, but thank you for facilitating Charles Schwab's sponsorship. That's not easy to say, Charles Schwab's sponsorship. But I'll get used to it, of the ILS lecture program. Thank you very much. Before I introduce our gold sponsor for the evening, I just also want to say how excited I am personally as a one-time professor of contemporary novel to have Michael Ondaatje here at Dominican this evening, someone whose work I have been tremendously moved by and have helped students discover the richness of years ago, and this is the first time I'm having the opportunity to hear him speak in person. And that was made possible by our gold sponsor. Tonight's highly, and to here to introduce Michael Ondaatje is Nikki Sloan, Executive Vice President and Head of Growth and Strategy for Bank of Marin, our gold sponsor. Nikki is a 30-year veteran within the banking and lending industry. She currently leads the day-to-day execution of Bank of Marin's strategic plan, which includes amplifying growth and enhancing capabilities in key divisions such as treasury management, wealth management, and trust marketing. And Nikki has also been a great friend and supporter of Dominican. So with that, I introduce Nikki Sloan, and we're excited to get the program properly underway. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, President Pitchford. I'm honored to welcome our speakers this evening, Michael Ondaatje and Michael David Lucas. We're here to celebrate Michael Ondaatje's long-awaited return to poetry in A Year of Last Things Poems. From one of the most influential writers of his generation, A Year of Last Things is a gorgeous, surprising poetry collection about memory, history, and the act of looking back. Mr. Ondaatje's poems are sometimes witty, sometimes moving, and always wise, taking us back through time by way of alchemical leaps, unearthing writings by revered masters, moments of shared tenderness, and the abandoned landscapes we hold onto and rediscovering the influence of every border crossed. Michael Ondaatje is the author of 7 novels, a memoir, a nonfiction book on film, and several books on poetry. He's received many prestigious awards, including the Booker Prize in 1992 for his novel, The English Patient, which became a major motion picture that won 9 Academy Awards, including Best Film. Mr. Ondaatje was born in Sri Lanka and now lives in Toronto. Facilitating tonight's conversation is award-winning and best-selling author Michael David Lucas. His debut novel, The Oracle of Istanbul, was an international bestseller and translated into more than a dozen languages. His second novel was the award-winning The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. Mr. Lucas's writing has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Slate, National Geographic Traveler, and Georgia Review. He lives in Oakland and teaches at our very own San Francisco State University. We're in for a rich and thought-provoking discussion this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce Michael Ondaatje and Michael David Lucas to Dominican University. Let's welcome them to our stage.
The epigraph to this book is by Marguerite Duras, and she wrote, "Writing isn't just telling stories, it's telling everything all at once." This poem is called Lock. Reading the lines he loves, he slips them into a pocket, wishes to die with his clothes full of torn free stanzas and the telephone numbers of his children in far cities. As if these were all we need and want, not the dog or silver bowl, nor the brag of career or ownership, unless they can be used, a bowl to beg with, a howl to scent a friend, as those torn lines remind us how to recall. Until we reach that horizon and drop or rise like a canoe within a lock, to search the other half of the river, where you might see your friends as altered by this altitude as you. the fresh summer grass, the smell of the view, dark water, August paint. How I loved that lock when I saw it all those summers ago, when we arrived out of a storm into its evening light and gave a stranger some wine in a tin cup. Even then I wanted to slip into the wet, dark rectangle and swim on barefoot to other depths where nothing could be seen. That was a further story. Five a.m. The wilderness of our youth, an empty barn, dancing with friends into the small hours, then daylight, and the cars swerving away, wordless, into the dawn. It arrives all at once tonight, not as memory, but like a gift from forgetfulness, as a desire can wake you, or this poem based on the accidental change of speed in a friend's camera into slow motion. So now I remember the rest of our shadows as we danced, all our heartbeats under the thunder. And I can speak to you the way we once sang farewells out of our cars late at night, when those goodbyes remembered everything. Two photographs. It was years earlier, you in an old bathtub with barely a few inches of water on an island, the weather outside unknown, but for the tan that surrounded your whiteness. Everything suggested an era long before the present, the late 60s perhaps, a weekday afternoon, with little to show how you spent your days, your nights, just two black and white photographs. The first capturing your gaze into nowhere. The other when you covered your face with your hands so you were not anonymous, only unseen, except perhaps by what you might be thinking. What was the year? Where was the house and town? Nothing given away by your silence and careful movement. Still practically a bride, you said, 20 years before we met. Another photograph I saw later, a more formal nude shaped by shadow, your bare back, you in a crouch, faceless, not so much your image, but a husband's hovering with a camera, where everything casual in the earlier pictures with that bathtub and raw sunlight made him your husband's masterpiece. The secret of your look, the recall of an afternoon when things will hold or fall away. It is in these pictures, being the unknown stranger, I hold a complete belief in you, long before we met. How did we meet? I whisper even now, as if magically, that first time landing after a far journey upon a dark, hardly lit island late at night, and then somehow solitary with you in what, for all I know, was a crowded car. This poem is called Definition and began with me looking at a Sanskrit dictionary and improvising off that. All afternoon I stroll the plotless 1,300 pages of a Sanskrit dictionary with its verbs for holy obsessions, the name for an alcove of coin washers whose fingers glint all night with dark lead grains of silver. Here root vowels take an accent at high altitudes, the way dictionaries speak over mountains, a single word to portray light from that distant village reflected in a cloud, or your lover's face lit by the moonlight on a stage. Landscapes nudge the dialect. In far places, travelers know a faint gesture can mean desire or scorn, just as a sliver of a phrase thrown away hides charms within its grammar. A guru, someone with a light touch, derives from that short vowel alone and before a single consonant. Wherever you turn, definitions push open a door, the precisely named odor of a man who is a heart thief, a word for the highest complication during a play, used also for impregnation. Attributes of character link themselves to professions, a metal worker, the river merchant, the commissioner of oaths, the census taker of birds who continues the medieval art of whistling. Those who carry bees on their arm like a dark flame, the sullen recluse who was once the author of a prayer. This word for a pool beside a temple, or answer, the shape of a shoulder blade, as in the corner of a holy quadrangle. The ancient phrases give you the coin of escape, that epithet for those who return to broken relationships repeatedly, will row you away from confusion, or remain only for remembrance. This is how deep I was lost, my darling, in a love so narcotic I possessed unimpaired splendor, having no other want or wish. What was there before there was the warmth of that word for your shoulder blade? Or that time before we moved to a freedom from desire.
Oh, sorry about that. That was really lovely. I just want to start by saying how honored I am and how great it is to have you here and to celebrate you and this book, which I read over the past few days and really, I feel like, reoriented me towards language and towards my own life and memory. So thank you for that. I think my first question is just thinking about, I was looking over your work and came across one passage right at the beginning of Running in the Family, mm-hmm. your memoir, and right at the beginning it says, for 25 years he has not lived in this country, though up to the age of 11 he slept in rooms like this. This is your first book of poetry in about 25 years. What's it like to return to this room of poetry?
That's an interesting parallel, because I think that's very much what I felt when I... Is my mic on? Oh, no. That's a thing here.
Okay, is it on now? I'm glad someone said something. It's a very similar situation, because, you know, I'd left Sri Lanka when I was a kid and didn't go back for about almost 30 years. And so I was in a new place, and it was also having new ears, having a new voice. And that's very much like moving from fiction, or a number of years of fiction, to poetry, where you are, in fact, you know, spending all your time now with a new language that you haven't used for a long time.
Yeah.
And in many of my books, I've gone from, you know, I began with poetry, and then I moved to fiction gradually, and then after about 10 or 15 years, I started writing poetry again. And it's you know, it's like having a new voice being given to you, and not with, along with a voice, you're just seeing things very, very differently. Mm. So that's very, I think, apt parallel between going back to Sri Lanka and reliving something.
You know? Were you glad? What was the impetus that brought you back? Was it a good return? Was it a difficult return? Was it
to poetry?
To poetry, yeah.
Yeah, I think. I think I'd written about two or three novels, and I was, you know, I was very close to them, obviously, and each novel takes about 5 or 6 years. So you know, numerous rewrites. So you're kind of in a fully into what, some kind of language or tone or pitch or, you know, plot. And I just needed to do something else, I think, you know, and I very determined, actually, when COVID began, it was like this little gift. I became a more private person and had a more private life, and I decided to want to go back. I wanted to go back to poetry, which I had begun with. And I was very uncertain if I could go back to poetry, because it's, you know, a completely different set of values and rules and line breaks and so forth, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting that you say that it allowed you that sort of privateness of poetry, because I know your work through your novels. And actually, the first book I read was the collected works of Billy the Kid, which is kind of right on the line between poetry and novel and prose. But I feel like reading your novels, I always had a sense of the author is in here somewhere. I feel him. I mean, with Cat's Table in particular, I you know, the protagonist is named Michael, and his life, you know, mirrors yours in a lot of ways. But this book, I really felt, whether that feeling is true or not, I really felt an intimate sort of connection with you as as a person or with the speaker. And I wonder what it is like to kind of, in that private moment, also show yourself in a way that maybe you haven't in the past.
Yeah, I think it's dodgy, you know. but, you know, I think that intimacy is actually what appealed to me when I was working on this book, because I wasn't sure if this was going to work as a poem, let alone a book, you know. And I think that Margaret Duras quote is interesting, because I'm not just talking about myself now, you know, but I'm talking about myself as a young boy, or the 5 a.m. poem I read, you know, young people dancing in a barn or something like that. And so it was, or talking about a relationship with your partner and writing about her when you didn't know her. You know, so I mean, that was all very interesting, and going backwards and forwards. And as a result, what happened after writing these, you know, I don't know how many, 50 poems or something like that, having to find a structure to the book, you know, so that, because it didn't move A, B, C, D, it went F, A, L, K, you know, and so you wanted to kind of structure it in a way that would make some sense to the reader, you know.
Yeah.
It
did make so much sense. I mean, there's also formal differences. I think the second to last section is all one prose poem.
Yes.
Or maybe, and yeah, but it all flowed beautifully. How did you, I mean, I've read, you've written beautifully about structuring fiction, particularly in your book, The Conversations, which is about film editing, but you know, there's obviously the corollary to fiction. How do you go about structuring a book of poems?
Well, I know when I was thinking about the collected works of Billy the Kid, which you mentioned, because I remember that was the first attempt I made from poetry to including prose. You know, if it was going to be a Western, it couldn't just be poetry. It had to be cowboys leaping on horses and going to the next town and causing trouble and coming back, you know, that kind of plot line, you know. So I remember placing all these sections I'd written, not necessarily yet in the right chronological order for a book, and looking down and going, no, this is too close to this. You have to have a lyric here, and that would create more tension between the drama and the lyric, you know. So, and in many ways, that remembering that structure or attempting a different structure to the one you wrote in became very interesting to me in the book.
So you mentioned a couple of the sort of themes that you return to. It is a book about memory, but what I loved is it's about these kind of ghost memories, like
the memory of your lover before you met her, mm-hmm. or the lives you didn't live.
Yes.
But one of the things that really struck me was the subject of the poems is multifarious. It's lots of different people, and many of them are friends. Mm-hmm. I just loved the way that you wrote about friendship. I'm curious to hear you talk mm-hmm. about how friendship sort of sustains you as a writer, both friends with writers and non-writers.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, writers are not solitary people. So, yeah. you depend on friends and you depend on, you know, who influences you all through your life, you know, and then you are often surprised when you go back, especially when you're writing, you go back and try to, well, it was that person who reminded me about this. And what was quite odd about this book was because at some point in this book, I talk about a character called Skanda, who appears in an earlier novel, mm-hmm. or in fact, a couple of places. And the name was a name I remembered from being at school in Sri Lanka as a 10-year-old boy. So suddenly this character, now I bring back into the plot of this story, and, you know, and suddenly you realize that, you know, he's a live force. He's not just a character in a book. So he can do different things. And that was actually the most moving thing to kind of find in a way, and that I could go back and re-articulate a character, you know.
Well, yeah, no, that was like one of those ghost memories. Like,
yes.
It was the memory of a friendship that mm-hmm. was actually a friendship with a character you wrote.
Yeah.
And then that veers off into, you know, Father Barnabas.
Oh, yes, the killer.
So the title of the book, A Year of Last Things, mm. is, you know, has this sort of elegiac tone to it. And I was wondering, that poem, November, really struck mm-hmm. me. I was wondering if you might read that.
Yeah, sure.
And then also maybe just talk about that poem and the sort of feeling of looking back and what it's like to write a book of poetry like that.
Yeah. Should read up there or down here? Or
whatever you like.
I'll read that and then some other ones and then I'll come back, okay. This is called November. Where is my dear 16-year-old cat? I wish to carry upstairs in my arms, looking up at me and thinking, be careful, dear human. 16 years. How many days since I found you as if an urchin in a snowstorm? And you moved in, assured, learned the territories of the house and what became your garden. Only now do we see the horizon where you paused two or three times, then slipped into. Was it too soon or too late, that last summer of your life, when we watched you walk down to a river to take a sip from its ongoing pleasure? Oh, Jack, I miss your presence everywhere, in the corner of rooms, in every chair, or nesting in a cardboard box. Take me back where the past can again enter those early remembered rooms, our snowbound street. Lift me upside down in your arms. I cannot stand it. I need a journey too. Have I slept my life away? Do I understand anything? Will I wear a bell like yours into the afterlife where language no longer exists and we gather only linked sounds like oars from a passing boat, those few syllables to recall tenderness. You no longer wait for us. All day long, Basho wrote a lark sings in the air, yet he seems to have had not quite his fill. I was going to read something, actually, a prose, which is not in this book, as it seemed sort of apt for the time. So if you don't mind, I'll read that. This is from Divisadero, which I wrote not very far away from here in Petaluma many years ago. While the two men worked in the fields, Aria and the boy went south, riding into the fertile lands. They stopped wherever they wished. Raphael built a fire while Aria coursed over the fields, looking for things to eat, an onion or two, rosemary, leeks. Lunch was a collection of minor plants and shoots, as if gathered by a pair of birds rushing and diving over the fields. It was barely there on her tongue. When the meal was over, if the stream or river was private enough, they would strip off their clothes and swim. Aria was determined that Raphael never have a fear of water like his father, so she would laugh as she ran down the bank and then grin at him when she surfaced out of the river. She did not want a fearful child. Sometimes during their journey, great storms came at night out of the west from the ocean at Buzon. And when they were west of San Justine, lightning lit up the fire and river like a path through history, and she grabbed the boy to stop him from leaping into its brief beauty. It was a season of storms. She and Raphael kept the caravan in the middle of the open fields and let the horses loose. Released, they hardly moved, as if pretending that there was nothing dangerous, that it was safer than galloping into darkness. There were evenings when Aria and Raphael stood on the dry night grass with 100 layers of stars above them, uncountable, a million orchestras. The boy could scarcely store the delirious information. That journey south with his mother and the return north broke his heart again and again with happiness. It was when he felt most clearly that there was no distinction between himself and what was beyond him. A tree's sigh or his mother's song could, it seemed, have been generated by his body, just as whatever gesture he made was an act performed by the world around him. They were a few miles north of Plaisance when the eclipse paused over the Gers. The darkness came fast into the afternoon. Raphael was lifting a pail for a nervous horse to drink from and became conscious of the darkness only because it was growing cold. He spun around and saw his mother looking at him with concern. Gray rain started falling in the half-light, though it was the wind that bewildered everything, arcing the trees down so they hovered almost parallel to the ground. He saw the horse's eye lolling, distracted in front of him, as if it too were part of this peculiar nature. He did not know what an eclipse was. He thought it might be some vengeance that came with the end of the world. He was holding the horse's neck, looking for rope to secure the animal, but there was none. So he held onto the mane with his hands. If the horse got loose, they would never find it. When the animal began to pivot, he swung himself onto its back, just as his mother yelled out, "No!" And the horse burst through the trees into further darkness with the boy upon it. Raphael put his head down against the horse's neck, and he became the horse's eyes, witnessing the quick choices of direction. He was saddleless, clinging to the wet-coated creature in its tumbles and swerves, until it emerged into a vast field where the sky was a shade lighter than under the trees. The horse now doubled its speed and flung itself into the open. The boy could hear his own breath alongside the breath of the horse. He could hear the hooves in the long grass, their sudden clatter over a wooden bridge after the muted sound of the earth. He was holding onto the warm blood of the animal. For perhaps a minute, time was a measureless moment now. They had gone through a village where only the two of them moved in the darkness, the boy's leg brushing a cart, then a child. And then they had come through it into fields again beside the river. Then there was a slow burning of light, and there was a heat once more around them and in the wet grass. Time was in a broken state. The sky appeared filled with bright moonlight, though it was day. The horse calmed, aware now of the fly-like rider whose knees clutched it, the boy's feet bare from another time when they were serene under the trees and he'd approached the horse with a pail of water. Raphael rode back slowly, field after field. They were all new to him. He looked for the village, but whatever community they'd rushed through, he never encountered again. They crossed over the wooden bridge, then saw the black horizon of forest, and soon he could make out his mother pacing on the edge of it. He never hurried the horse. He finally dismounted, lying back and sliding off the slippery wall of the animal. He could hardly stand in front of Aria, though he did, shaken by her, and then embraced. I'll read a couple more poems. One I thought I'd read was about being at school in England. I grew up in Sri Lanka, where I went to this wretched school in Sri Lanka, and then I went to school in England, which I went to a wretched school. And they had a system where if you were good at one subject, you ended up in the Latin sixth or the, English sixth or whatever the final year was. And if you were not good at anything, you ended up in the geography sixth. So I'm going to read a poem about that and then have more conversation, hopefully. We were the unselected ones, minors in our youth, kept from certain classrooms without knowledge of what was taught there. The complex sciences, foreign novels, even rhetoric and courtesy that might help on some future afternoon within the corridors of power. While we were stalled in the geography sixth, studying floodplains, maps of far pilgrimages, coastal profiles of islands drawn by mariners in earlier times. Still, I made my best friends there in that class, where we talked without pause and with no fear of boredom. David Giron, Stuart Blackler, Jeff Mayle, Jeremy Bottle, all my sad captains, raucous beyond midnight at that wise age of 17. In retrospect, we were only discovering ourselves, immersing ourselves in unnecessary things, hard-boiled thrillers, how to tap a phone, the rag and bone blues of Radio Luxembourg. We slipped from a school into a dark field, drank from a bottle, rode a loose horse, and were thrown, while RB, name withheld, hoisted his Chinese girlfriend, a composer's only daughter, on a rope up to a second floor dormitory, her slipper floating to earth. It would be a decade, though it felt just a weekend, before I stood in front of a fragonard in the Wallace collection, its rapid brushwork of the woman's dress on a swing, reminding me of their quiet whispers as they plotted her ascent. Then noticed that shoe in midair, leaving her right foot, the lighter genius of fragonard. It was some time before we were drawn to erotic pleasures and the disguises of clothing, a long dove gray shirt on an idle bride, in a mountainous thriller, that air blue gown in a stanza of Hardy, those evolving disguises of the Count of Monte Cristo, or in the way Stendhal owned 350 pseudonyms, for he disliked the first person pronoun. It was now escape from our contained lives that obsessed us, as when Julien in The Red and the Black from a wife's window leapt during an interrupted seduction into the dark and was chased by friendly guards who saw him, who knew him well, and those dogs, while a husband's bullets whistled past him. You close a perfect chapter and it sounds like a gunshot I read in a Polish essay and knew where it came from. We were witnessing how characters evolved from a fragment to become assured, though more damaged, revealed, but better hidden. Youth never remains a sentence. Even if some were pulled by thick ropes into dormitories, while others, thrown by the horse, lay drunk on the grass without hope of significant life. And yet, with those dutiful maps of pilgrimages had come the sudden discoveries of unnamed islands, though we still had no idea whether we might leap up or down into a further story.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
And I appreciate it because it is a nice segue to my next question, which I think that just listening to you read, you know, switch back and forth between poetry and prose, mm-hmm. I think solidified for me just how poetic your prose is and how novelistic your poetry is, which is great to me. In both senses. And I'm curious what you make of that line as someone who exists on either side of it,
yeah.
And how you decide whether a particular germ or idea goes in this direction or that
yeah.
direction.
There's a wonderful remark Don DeLillo says, I think it wrote it down here, it actually fits in with what you're saying. He said, if I were a writer, how I would enjoy being told the novel is dead. How liberating to work on the margins outside a central perception. And, you know, I think there's a pleasure in that. You know, I mean, every writer, when they begin a book, even if they've written five novels, they want that next novel to be something vagrant, you know,
mm-hmm.
Something that can find a new voice. In a way, that the voice I was talking about earlier on. And I think that's the real pleasure of that, you know. And you're not quite sure what you're going. I mean, this book was written with a lot of uncertainty, you know. First of all, I haven't written a book of poem in 20 years. And it just became so essential for me to try and make it work and obviously withdraw something from my past. I mean, draw something from the past in terms of my own life, but also in terms of what you learn about prose, you know, and that language. And I think the DeLillo quote is kind of interesting because it gives you a huge freedom to, you know, if you don't have the basic rules of a novel or a poem, you know, you can discover it and it becomes more exciting, I think.
Yeah, and when you're making discoveries as an author, that's the best reading experience.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing that I was thinking when you were reading is that passage that you read is, in thinking back on sort of your work before I actually picked up the books again, I was sort of hit by like a half dozen moments that just stayed with me, and I didn't always know which book they were in, but
yeah.
they were, I could
I'm
see
not
them.
Sure either,
yeah, it was like I had lived them.
Yeah.
And there's one moment in particular that is just really stays with me when in the Cat's Table, when the ship goes through the Suez Canal, and there's just all this activity. Someone throws an orange on board, and there's just this amazing sense of possibility and aliveness. And then in the next chapter, one of the characters is obsessed with that moment also. So that made me...
And becomes a painter.
And becomes a painter, and all of his paintings are of this moment. And so what I'm wondering is, for you, do you start with that moment, or do you come to that type of moment in the process, or...
I came to that moment. You know, I was about almost halfway through the book, and it was almost like the landscape of a trip from Asia to England will go through the Suez Canal, which is like a halfway point. Mm-hmm. And it was like end of Act One. And you know, the end of Act One is always, especially if there hasn't been an act break, is always fantastic. You know, if you think of all those movies, you know, with Tom Courtney on a train and something happens to him there. But that Suez Canal was like the end of an act. It was like a halfway point, in fact. And I had no idea about writing that scene until I started to write it, you know.
Wow.
And also, I have to admit that I don't remember the journey to the Suez Canal much, which gave me a huge freedom, you know.
Yeah. But, like, how beautiful is it that you don't remember it and then you create this memory in thousands of people's minds that are just staying with them as if they had lived it?
Yeah, complete fake.
Yeah, but it's like one of those super fake handbags that is indistinguishable from the real thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, it often happens. I mean, sure, if you kind of ask some writer about what scene we remember of that book, they're saying, oh yeah, that one, I remember that one, but I don't remember it that well, you know. Yeah. And I do remember that one well, but it was not having really witnessed, but it was imagining it, but with some information about, you know, the pores of the canal or the speed of the canal and so forth.
I wrote in my first book, there was a fake novel that I put in there, and I had a couple excerpts from it. And it was kind of annoying that, like, one of the most common questions I would get was like, I've been looking for that novel everywhere and I can't find it.
That's wonderful. That's great.
But, like, that's sort of like the only way you can write a perfect novel is if it doesn't actually exist.
Or it gets lost.
Or it gets lost, So, as someone who writes about history also, I'm especially curious. A lot of your books are set in the past. And oftentimes in sort of contentious, violent moments in the past. There's an author's note at the beginning of Annals Ghost. Annals Ghost is a fictional work set during this political time and historical moment. And while there existed organizations similar to those in the story and similar events took place, the characters, incidents, and the novels are invented. And I just love the way that that author's note situates the book in the past, but also sort of takes it out of it at the same time. Like it's existing in this kind of parallel to history. And so the question is, what, as someone who is writing about the past, do you feel like is your responsibility to history?
Well, that's, you know, that's always that responsibility. You know, you don't kind of ignore it, you know, but you only know so much. I mean, even if you go back now to some place and try and investigate what happened there, it's very difficult. And what I needed to do was, and when I was writing Anil's Ghost, you know, there was, you know, there were articles in England about what was happening in Sri Lanka or whatever it was. And so I went there without all that kind of prearranged, you know, plan. And I just talked to a lot of doctors. I mean, that was one of the things I did. And there were doctors not just in Colombo and, you know, other parts of the cities, but who were in the in the neutral, semi-neutral zone where there were, the war was going on. And I spent a lot of time there, and you were just learning about daily life. Mm. So, you know, for instance, if they were doing a, performing an operation, they would always listen to the radio, you know, and if the radio station was playing it in English, then they had to translate it so that, you know, the cricket match could continue, you know. And somehow that kind of intricate, you know, doubling of the reality of a war mm-hmm. convinced me that this was more believable in a way, you know,
yeah.
than usual guns going off.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what made it feel so resonant, I think, mm-hmm. is those little details and yeah. Let's see here. So many of your books, I was thinking about, really deal with, I mean, colonialism, war, really highly charged mm-hmm. topics. And yet, they don't feel like capital P political,
mm-hmm.
because they're so rooted in the characters' experiences. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about your thoughts about how politics does and should live in literature.
I don't think there's any rule about that. You know,
yeah.
I really think, you know, I could just as validly read a very political book with fury in it, you know, as one that kind of depicts a world. I mean, I think one of the things that was happening when I wrote Anil's Ghost, which is a very, obviously, a central book in terms of the subject, was, you know, that there was all these kind of very, like, 500-word editorials about what was happening there. And I just didn't want to kind of fall into those kind of truisms, you know, or tropes. And so I essentially kept it, you know, I was dealing with real people as opposed to, you know, the political voice, you know, I think. It may be an error, but I, you know, that's, I think what I felt that.
We're getting towards the end, but I do have a couple last questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, totally unrelated to this conversation, just about thinking about who are my favorite living writers, and when I was making that list in my mind, so many of them were Canadian.
Oh.
You, Alice Munro, Margaret Atwood, Emily St. John Mandel, all kinds, so many others. And it got me thinking, like, is there something about being Canadian that, is there some ethos of Canadianness? I mean, so many of my best friends are Canadian, which uh-huh. sounds like a weird thing to say, but it's very true. And is it me resonating with this Canadianness, or is there something that you feel sets, you know, Canadian authors apart from the rest of Anglophone literature, and what is that?
I've never thought about this puzzle. no, I don't know. The water? You know? I think what happened was there was a lot of watching from Canada south of the border to what was happening in American literature. I mean, I think one of the interesting things that happened when I was writing this book was that you know, thin line between fiction and poetry. Hmm. You know, so I'm along with some other writers in Canada, especially an amphibious writer. You know, I'm water, land, fine. You know, but you find that in American literature. You know, Raymond Carver, who is a great short story writer, is an even better poet, I think, you know. And it's just wonderful. I spent a lot of time reading his poetry again. And there are stunning poems, which I hadn't read until about 8 years ago. You know. And I don't know why the Canadians are suddenly kind of temporarily, you know, doing well. But, you know, Mavis Gallant is another great, you know, Canadian writer. So I think, I don't know, I'm not quite, I'm stunned by this question.
I was like, oh gosh, she's heard this question so many times, this could be annoying.
Never been asked before.
Yeah. And then just to end, what are some writers living or dead that you feel like your work is in conversation with or is inspiring you or kind of getting you out of bed in the morning?
I'm having difficulty reading books right now. I mean, I think partly because I was writing poetry, I couldn't quite get into novels again, you know. So it was odd books like When We Cease to Understand the World, you know.
Oh, I love that book. Yeah.
I mean, it's quite startling. And then, you know, of course, every name has gone from my head right away. But so I can't even give you a name now, but I love the short, great novels, mostly, you know. I mean, so I'm fading on that question, sorry.
No, no problem. But who do you feel like your work is in conversation with in sort of like a global sense? Like, who are you writing towards in the sort of like great dinner party of literature?
I've never been invited to the great dinner party. So it's not going to happen, but I don't know. It's a tough question. This is, you know, you've got to give me a more warning.
Tom, I'm giving you tough ones. I thought these were...
I don't know. I mean, every writer I like, I kind of... the names have suddenly slid into the darkness. I'm sorry. I can give you some names sometimes. I mean, DeLillo was very, very good at one time. And... so, and some of the poets, you know, I mean, Polish poetry interested me during this time. Perhaps I could read one poem to answer your question.
That'd be wonderful.
Because it goes outside of the usual location. It's called Wanderer. Let us speak about our enormous flaws as told to us by others. Accountants, wives before leaving, about how we deceived ourselves, even our dogs, by ignoring their concerned pre-walk, tear-stained howls, though they rested often on our chests, making sounds like old ships. For there is only, but always, a small tunnel of escape for forgiveness. As with any novel or film, you hang onto character rights and where you came from. There's not much to leave when you're only 15, we are told. My friend's family in Warsaw during the war was fed and kept alive by a German deserter who roamed Europe like Odysseus, even joining them in their escape, pretending to be mute while they taught him Polish. A dissolved genealogy that let him cross borders and war zones with them, finding a path through various armies. He knew already the great engines of this world do not run on faithfulness. Without a homeland, he was for a while a father to his children. And later, more than once, needing a passport, he married more than once. With dialects and port-accented verbs, he could sing in four languages about departure. He belonged still to himself at 15, waiting for the later years to reach him. Who had he become? He'd bunked beside Isaiah, escaped judgment, remained as if impenitent. He felt comforted only when, as with the dog, it became difficult to know if accusations meant damnation or contentment. I don't obviously answer your question fully, but I think that whole idea now of this multicultural voice in literature is just wonderful, you know. I mean, this is a friend of mine, and he told me the story. God, you know, that's a real life, you know, and that's a real experience. Yeah. And it wasn't really written about very much, you know, until our time. You know, the gift of translation we've been given is fantastic.
Yeah. But I love that because there's that, and then there's also just like the humanness.
Yeah.
You know, he's stripped of his identity and just becomes a person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is really lovely.
Thank you all so much for being part of this really almost sacred evening. I'm so glad you were with us. And please come back Tuesday for Amy Tan's event at 7 o'clock right here. And then May 7th the subjects that Denise lets us bring are, and Jin Saki on the 7th. It's just wonderful to have this community with us and to have the thrill of being here while Michael Andace and was talking to Michael David Lucas. What a night. Thank you.